right into it. I know your time is valuable. Okay, it is...
You're doing a little fading in and out if you
can
just stay close to the box.
Okay, I'll try. When it rains, it pours at the FCIC. It is November 15th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. Robert Diamond of Barclays. Mr. Diamond, my name's Chris Seifer. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. That tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis, deliver a report to Congress by the end of the year. That statute tells us to look at many things, including the causes of the failure or near failure of institutions that received exceptional government assistance. Therefore, one of the institutions we're looking at is Lehman Brothers, so of course we thought it made eminent sense to talk to you about the efforts to acquire that company, including the acquisition of the broker-dealer out of bankruptcy. So I'll be asking you about that, but before we do that, as we talked a little bit about before we turned on the tape, could you first please just summarize your educational and work background, starting with college, and then we'll get into the substance of the interview.
Educational background is Colby College, class of 1973. My major was economics. My minor was education. I then had a master's degree from the University of Connecticut School of Business, 1977. I don't think this counts in terms of what you're saying, but I've been awarded an honorary doctorate from both institutions over the last couple of years, but those are honorary.
Okay.
And I stay involved in education as chairman of the Board of Trustees of Colby College, and have been a member of the Board of Trustees for about 20 years.
Okay.
Did you say employment as well?
Yes, please.
Did you say education? Sorry. So that completes education. In terms of employment, I began as an instructor at the School of Business while I was getting my master's degree at the University of Connecticut. Prior to that was more summer employment and earning money for school, so I'll skip over the various things there. I then worked for U.S. Surgical Corporation in Stamford, Connecticut from 1977 to 79 after graduating from the University of Connecticut Graduate School. I left there in 1979 to join Morgan Stanley in the Management Information Systems Department, Information Technology, it would be referred to today, I think, so the systems area and technology area, computer area. I spent the next 13 years at Morgan Stanley, both in New York and the last 5 years in London. At that time, I was a managing director and in charge of international fixed income trading, which covered most of the trading area outside of the U.S., but was primarily the U.K., Europe, and Japan in terms of where our business was and where the markets were active. I left Morgan Stanley in 1992 to join Credit Suisse First Boston as the on the executive committee, member of the group executive committee, and responsible for all businesses in Asia. Our family at that point moved from London to Tokyo, where we lived for the next couple of years. And my role, while maintaining membership of the group executive committee, switched from a regional role of running Asia to a functional role of running the Global Fixed Income and Foreign Exchange Division. My entire time at Credit Suisse First Boston was 4 years. It was split about equally between the regional role and then the global role. Having left there, I joined Barclays in the summer of 1996, originally as a member of the executive team and management committee in their investment bank, which at the time was called Barclays to Zoot Wed. About a year later, we restructured the business into what is today Barclays Capital, where I was the chief executive of Barclays Capital from the beginning, which was November of 1997. I'm still with Barclays today in 2010. And today I am the president of the group, the chief executive designate to take over in the new year from John Barley, who's the current group chief executive. At various times over the last over the 14 years that I've been with Barclays, I've been chief executive of the investment bank, chairman of the investment management business, which was Barclays Global Investors, responsible for our wealth business, which is Barclays Wealth, a member of the group executive committee since 1997, a member of the board, a director on the board for about 5 years now, and recently have assumed a number of group-wide functions around talent, and human resources, brand and marketing as preparation for taking over as group chief executive early next year.
Okay, thank you. So I think what I want to cover first is Lehman, and let me just tell you a few things I do know that hopefully will help maybe shorten it up a bit. We have either seen in documents or in interviews, you know, heard about apparently the initial call from Mr. Steele in April of 08 to you asking Barclays to take a look at Lehman, and then we've seen or heard that in June of 08 the issue was at least broached with the board at Barclays. I don't know a whole lot beyond that in terms of Barclays until we actually get to Lehman weekend. So what I'd like you to do is just sort of walk us through, you know, from the beginning when Barclays was first looking at Lehman, and in that regard, you know, tell us what you found at Lehman, and help and summarize your discussions with folks at Lehman, discussions with folks from the U.S. government, and discussions with folks with the U.K. government. If you could do that, that would be helpful, and we'll follow up after we get the story first.
Chris, maybe I'll take it in chunks.
Sure.
And then you can encourage me on the next chunk as we go along. I don't want to appear that I'm stopping short of what you want, but it's such a long period of time and so many things intertwine. I'll kind of give pieces, and then you encourage me if the piece that would be best for you next, if that sounds good.
That would be great. Thank you.
I think most of what I have read about the call from Bob Steele seems to be reasonably accurate. But to put it in my words, it was in April of 2008. It was shortly after the Bear Stearns collapse and the integration of Bear Stearns and the decision to integrate Bear Stearns with J.P. Morgan with some government guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wake of that, I had a call from Bob Steele, who was the Undersecretary of the Treasury. I think to put that in context, in a time with so much stress in the financial markets, Bob was someone I was keeping in touch with on a regular basis because of his position in the Treasury. And because we had known each other for a number of years, he was a good conduit for me, and it would have been more difficult, as you can imagine, to have that kind of a regular contact with the Secretary himself, nor was it necessary.
Mm-hmm.
The call from Bob in April really posed two questions to me. I've always pointed out that I knew this wasn't official, and he said it wasn't official. It was to get me thinking. But he said, in the wake of the collapse of Bear Stearns, if there were another leg down in the market, and if, for example, Lehman Brothers were in trouble, is there a price at which an acquisition of Lehman Brothers made sense for Barclays? And if so, what would we need from, I don't recall if he said from the Treasury or from the administration or how he phrased it, but he was saying, what would you need from us, if I could phrase it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a very good question. We had not thought very much about it, although it was interesting to a number of institutions post Bear Stearns that the decision to combine Bear with J.P. Morgan was taken before many people were aware that there was that situation, if I could say it that way.
Mm-hmm. So
if I could back up. That was a good chunk. I'll stop here.
So the only one follow up question I had on there. So in the April 08 phone call with Mr. Steele, at that time he was talking about the possibility of Barclays acquiring Lehman with government assistance. Was there discussion about Barclays interested in Lehman without government assistance?
At that time, I don't recall anything that got anywhere close to that at that time. And I didn't take his question of what would you need from us just in that context. C- Chris. I took it more broadly, meaning do you need information? Would you need guidance? Do you need meetings? And I suppose, I don't think my mind went there right away of whether that meant government assistance at all. I took it at a much higher level. And so I certainly didn't walk away from that thinking there was an inference one way or the other.
Okay.
Nor do I think Bob intended there to be an inference one way or the other.
Okay. And was the call just about Lehman, or was he asking you about other shops too?
So my recollection was both, in the sense that I would say primarily Lehman, and that he specifically mentioned Lehman. He talked about the reason he thought of making a call is because of the interesting combination of the two firms, and he talked about if a situation like that came, that my skill set and being, you know, having run both U.S. and international operations of organizations. But I also took it as, I think he was using Lehman as an example of if there was another leg down. So, quite frankly, I think I took it both ways. But the only organization we discussed by name was Lehman.
Okay. And then you mentioned that when the call, there were basically two questions on the call, and maybe I missed the second one, but I heard that the first one was, if there's another leg down, would you guys possibly be interested in Lehman, and if so, at what price? Or was that the second question, or did I just miss it?
No, that was the first question was, I would say it slightly differently. Is there a price at which you'd be interested in Lehman?
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was, if so, what would you need from us, or how can we help, or what, you know. I forget the exact words, Chris, right, in the second question, but it was what we were just talking about. It was, where do we go from here, kind of.
Okay, I got it. So if you could just continue on then. What next after the April 08 call?
Well, I think to put it in context, there was two strategic things going on within Barclays at the time which made this question intriguing. I think first is when it was clear in the summer of 2007 that when we saw the crack in the credit markets, if I could call it that,
mm-hmm.
With the results and write-downs from Merrill Lynch, from UBS, and from Citi, kind of in the third quarter of 2007.
Right.
We also knew that we would be impacted by, by the weaker financial markets because we had businesses in credit, which was the area that was showing the weakness. But we also knew, and I discussed with John Varley, and then John and I discussed with the board, that interestingly, this was likely also create opportunities. It was going to have to be managed. It was a potential crisis in the financial markets, which would impact us at Barclays and us at Barclays Capital. But it would also create opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And the first opportunity we thought about is the first write-downs were all either U.S. firms or the U.S. operations of international firms, in the case of UBS, was that this would be an opportunity for us to accelerate our build in the U.S.
Okay.
And to put that in perspective, Barclays Capital had grown originally as a U.K. sterling-based investment bank. We recognized that our first it was a strategic imperative to expand in the euro currency in Europe. And recall that BarCap started in 97 and the single currency started in 99, so we're anticipating those developments. And only then did we feel we would be strong enough, both from a strategic and operating point of view, to begin building our U.S. operations. And that really began in earnest in kind of the 2001 to 2004 period. But to be perfectly frank, we were strong, we were profitable, but we're definitely second or maybe even third tier in the U.S. relative to the big U.S. firms and relative to the most successful of the international firms. I would say at the time they were probably Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, and UBS.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw that opportunity. And the second thing I would say in context is we had already begun having discussions with UBS, who had significant write-downs in management and upheaval, both at the group level and in the investment bank, about whether or not there wasn't something we could do where we could take on some of their businesses in investment banking, particularly in Asia and particularly in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Those were very early stages, and they were there was substantive, but we had not reached any decisions. They were very, very private. But the reason I bring it up is you can imagine that this is something now that I was thinking of, John Varley was thinking of, and the board was thinking of, which is that on one hand, we have to manage very carefully through the difficult financial market situation, but on the other hand, there could be opportunities for us strategically, particularly in the U.S.
Right.
So with that background, the call was more interesting than just any call, if
right.
I could say it that way.
Sure.
And so the discussions with UBS, did those go back to the third quarter of 07, or were those going on in 08, or both?
Well, it was very, very late and very, very preliminary in the late third quarter of 07, and then, you know, two rather substantive meetings in the first quarter, very, very, very preliminary. I don't want to overcook this. Substantive in that they were real and senior, but... preliminary in that it was really I think four or five individuals combined from two organizations that were really involved.
And were those discussions still going on a preliminary basis in April of 08 when the Steele call comes?
Yeah, I only hesitate, Chris, because those conversations going on sounds like more than it was, since there had only been, you know, one preliminary meeting and two substantive ones. But to say it another way, they had not ended. We had not decided to walk away. We're still working on it, but we're facing some big hurdles.
Okay.
But they weren't over. No.
Okay. So understanding the context then, with those 2 points you make about how things were going since the fall of 07, now take us through what's going on. And to the extent you can, you know, weave in also what's going on with UBS. In terms of your discussions
well,
with that.
Well, as I said, I think I've probably finished with enough on UBS. It
okay.
was substantive in that it was real. There was interest on both sides, but it had massive challenges in terms of the difficulty of moving a business out of one organization onto another in terms of funding and balance sheet and other issues at a time of crisis. And there was also while we had a sincere interest, it wasn't a decision yet at UBS of whether or not they had how far they wanted to go.
Okay.
At the board level. So I would say then. So my reaction to this call, after informing John Varley, which is what I would do on any anything of this import, I met with my executive committee with John's okay, the Barclays Capital Executive Committee. And we did some what I would call desktop analysis, and it showed what we expected, which is that there was huge overlap between the two organizations. There's no question that there was an opportunity for us to have a breakout strategy in the U.S. because of Lehman's strength there. And it would provide an opportunity for us in equities, which was really, really important when we're looking both at the UBS business and now at this, is how can we find a place to have a real global equity business, but most importantly, have a U.S. foundation to an equities business. Strategically, that was a big challenge for us. But we walked away thinking that the overlap was way too big for it to work.
Mm-hmm.
There had been a call to me, I think once and maybe twice prior to this period, from the head of Lehman Brothers asking if there was an interest in having any discussions. It was very, very high level. It was very non-committal. And so without any of the desktop work, and I think it was just once before this period, but it could have been twice, the answer was very clear. There's way too much overlap. You know, there's no... We've never seen any example of two large investment banks like Barclays Capital and Lehman Brothers with all the people issues, the cultural issues, the technology issues, ever being successful in integration. And I recall mentioning the example of Credit Suisse, First Boston, and DLJ of having been one big and one small organization, and even that really struggled to create any value because so many of the people were disenfranchised and they lost a lot of the clients and the people. So we were not positive at all. On the first call from Lehman Brothers, nor had we been in the 12 or 13 years of building Barclays Capital. I had always been very clear with analysts, with investors, with media, that we were going to build this person by person, business by business, brick by brick. It was going to be organic. They shouldn't look for acquisitions. Acquisitions don't work in the financial services industry. They really don't work in the investment banking industry. And this was going to be an organic build. And for 12 or 13 years, that's exactly what it had been. And Barclays Capital had grown very successfully. It had the fastest growth of both revenue and profit growth of any investment bank over a 10-year period. And we had built it person by person, growing from 3,500 people in 1997 to about 15,000 at the time of the phone, roughly. I could be off by 1,000 either way, but circa 15,000 at the time of the phone call from Bob Steele. So the second context I would give you is we were looking for ways to hire people. We weren't looking for ways to buy businesses. We started out with a very strong bias that investment banking deals typically don't work. They destroy value. And we're really good at hiring people and building businesses and pay as you go.
Okay. So then, I mean, I guess just take us through it, but is there much more with Lehman until we actually get into September?
A little bit. And I think the big piece is, and I can't recall whether it was just kind of an itch that needed to be scratched or one of our executive committee members brought it back. My recollection is I said, let's take one more look at this. But there was something about the Bear Stearns, J.P. Morgan situation that caused me to push back a little bit and say, let's take another look. And I recall what we said is, let's just assume there is no price. How does it work? Take price off the table. And what we realized, and we had a little bit of outside work done, is it was transformational. Combining the U.S. business of Lehman Brothers with the international business of Barclays Capital, that's kind of the regional client business, and then combining the incredible strength of Barclays Capital in fixed income, currencies, and commodities with Lehman's business in equities and advisory. They had the others, but weren't as strong as us. And then saying that what I believed at the time was that the integrated universal banking model is the model that is best for clients, best for regulation, best for the markets. And I had felt for a while that the standalone bulge bracket investment bank would struggle over time in competing with the universal banks. But Lehman needed to do a deal, so they had to find a partner, much as Salomon had done with Citi, much as First Boston had done with Credit Suisse, and much as that summer Merrill Lynch did with B of A. So that was my strategy, and that was my public position anyway. And when we stripped away price, we found that there was an absolutely transformational strategic positioning for both organizations, but there was still huge overlap. So it would have to be done in a way where we could manage the overlap, particularly in Europe and Asia. It was just almost complete overlap.
So
that led us to the question of how would that work, and the only way that works is if the price, it has to be distressed both in price and in management, if I could say it this way. Both the price would have to be distressed, and the management would have to be in stress so we could have clarity of who's running the organization and who's making the decisions. It couldn't be a merger of equals in the sense of price or in the sense of two organizations coming together, because with a massive overlap, it was going to take one person to be in charge and to make all those decisions.
Right.
And so it struck us that if Lehman fell into a situation similar to there, that actually, I hate to say it this way, but it ticked both those boxes, clarity of management and clarity of value.
Mm-hmm. So in this earlier time,
support, we then took that proposal to the board and to have that discussion with our board.
And that was ballpark when?
Ah, You're going to hit me now. I'm going to say ballpark May-June.
Okay, and in that time frame, as you may recall, or maybe this will jog memory bells, both after Lehman reported first quarter results, right after the Bear JP Morgan deal was announced, and then again after they reported second quarter results in early June, more than a few people out there were questioning the write-downs that they had taken, Einhorn and others, and you know, making the point that, look, we think there's more questions about the real estate values that these folks are reporting. Back in the May-June time frame, when you guys are looking at Lehman, did you guys have concerns about the real estate values? What kind of dive did you do on those things?
Well, there was nothing we could do, first of all, because there was no public information. I think as the summer went on, Chris, and my recollection is soon after we had these discussions, Lehman raised some equity, had a bounce in the stock, and was much stronger for a period of time post-Bear than they had been during that time. But we weren't actively looking at it then. We're kind of doing a desktop, you know, executive committee, what if.
And I take it this
I think around the time we went to the board, is to your point, is there was a little bit more discussion now of this SpinCo and commercial real estate. So if you ask me to try and recollect what my feeling was around Lehman Brothers, if I go back into the kind of probably June, July period, it was that it appeared that they had a problem around commercial real estate that might be bigger than the market was expecting, but we didn't know a lot more than that. So there was one specific Lehman issue, and then there was, is that business model subject to difficulty in terms of market stress and market crisis in terms of funding and liquidity?
So in the June-July time frame, the desktop analysis, I take it, is based on publicly available information. You're not getting non-public information from Lehman? Okay, and then earlier
it's
you had,
it's still very high level.
Right. And earlier you had mentioned that I think even before the Steele call came, that the head of Lehman had contacted Barclays. Did you mean Mr. Fold by the head of Lehman?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and did he contact you?
No.
Okay, and again, that was before the Steele phone call in April of 2008.
Yeah, once, and I honestly cannot recall if it was the end of 07 or the beginning of 08, and it was very, I also don't want to overstate it. It was a call to discuss originally the Robin Hood Foundation that I know Dick Fold was very active in and asking if we could become more active in. And toward the end of the conversation, he kind of said it in a way of, there isn't something we should be talking about, is there? So it wasn't, is there a deal here for the two of us? It was more a question of, there isn't something we should be talking about, is there?
Okay. All right. So then after the desktop analysis in the June-July time frame, take us to what's next.
So I don't think a lot went on. We had one or two, again, very high-level conversations with the board. I know the first reaction of the board was, wow, be careful, that's a big firm. That was a legitimate reaction because I had been saying to the board for 13 years, this is an organic build. But the board was aware of our discussions with UBS. They were now aware, and as I said to them, keep in mind, this is something that we should just think about and be prepared for. But it only works from a management point of view and from a value point of view if it's in distress. And if it's in distress, that means that the markets are probably in more distress than they are today. But it's much better to have the conversation now so that if that happens, you know, we have clear vision of how we felt before the markets were in stress and the markets were in dislocation. Now, this wasn't a formal presentation at the board. It was part of John's chief executive's report where he and I discussed with the board that if obviously if it were real, there would be a due diligence required, but we don't have any information right now other than publicly available information. It was more to prepare the board for what could happen if markets lurch down.
Okay. So is the next thing then when we get into September and after they announce or pre-announce third quarter earnings on the 10th of September?
Yes, that's my recollection.
Okay, so I guess walk us through, I guess, September 10th through September 14th. I know a lot happened.
If you recall, Bob Steele had by this time left the Treasury.
Right.
And I can't remember when that was, but I think it was in the June-July time frame. It could have been July, August.
Yeah, in July he went to Wachovia.
Okay, so if I had it about right. I had a different contact that kept in regular touch, and his undersecretary was aware of discussions I had had with Bob in a general way, but it's not something that came up. I apologize. It was... Mr. Ryan, and I'm blanking out on his first name now.
I think it's Tony.
Yeah. Must have been. I had a discussion with him the week before, the week you're talking about, saying, asking him if he and or Bob had briefed Secretary Paulson and President Geithner on those conversations, because the markets were looking more stressed, and it looked possible that we're going to see a distressed situation for Lehman. This was before the pre-third quarter earnings.
And was it after Fannie and Freddie got put down?
I think it was that week. I think you're okay. Right. That was the week before, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was Labor Day weekend, September 7th, that Fannie and Freddie were placed into conservatorship.
So I'm pretty sure it was that week I had the conversation with Mr. Ryan. And I think he then... he told me that both were aware of those conversations, but my sense is he then briefed them on the call between he and I when I asked. I left one piece out. I apologize. Sometime after the April call from Bob Steele, with the authority of our board, after the one or two discussions we had at the board, so it was probably in the May-June time frame, maybe June-July, I went back to Bob and said that I have discussed this with the board. I took him through the process that I took you through. And the answer is that, yes, there is a price at which we would be interested, but it would be very, very distressed. And we would need to know that you are supporting us, given that we are a foreign-domiciled universal bank as opposed to a U.S.-domiciled bank. We would have to know that we have support from the Treasury and the Fed.
And again, in terms of
the other question after that was premature because everything was we didn't have any other information.
Okay.
So that was what I asked Mr. Ryan: is are you aware both of Bob's call to me and my response, which is yes, we would be interested, but the price would have to be distressed, and yes, we would need your support.
Okay. And when you say yes, we would need your support, just to try to keep it clear. I know you at least mean support in terms of we're a foreign domiciled company. We need your support in terms of, yes, this is a transaction that's doable. But does support also mean, you know, something more tangible?
No, but I didn't have enough information to know if that would be necessary or not. I think by saying distressed price, I was assuming it was going to be, you know, any of the issues Lehman were facing were in the price, quote unquote.
Okay.
And I don't think it wasn't until I had a very direct conversation with Secretary Paulson the following week when it was clear but unsurprising that Secretary Paulson let me know from the beginning being the next week, the week of September 10th,
mm-hmm.
that there was no appetite for government money in this deal. And my response was, I'm not surprised that you would say that, but I don't know what my answer to that would be until I've done my due diligence. But I hear you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just walk us through the week, if you can, please.
sometime on that week, on Monday or Tuesday, I had conversations with both President Geithner and Secretary Paulson. With President Geithner, it was, if I said it the other way around, I apologize. With President Geithner, he was encouraging me to call Mr. Fold and have the discussion with him. And it was a somewhat tense conversation, but what I said, and I had known President Geithner for many years, so we had a relationship where we could have a good conversation. But what I said is I brought him back to the discussion at the board, and both from a management point of view and evaluation point of view, it had to be in distress. And the market had gone too far. There wasn't going to be a friendly merger. It would only happen if Lehman were in distress and we had complete management. And I was very honest with him. I said, given the situation, are you telling me that you would, you would encourage the management team at Lehman to stay in situ? And he said, no, he wouldn't. And he understood. Well, let me say it differently. He didn't confirm anything about the management. He said he understands that my position, which is that we needed to be asked to come in by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, not by Lehman Brothers. But notwithstanding that, about 2 hours later, I got a call from Mr. Fold. So my sense was that he was aware of my conversations with either President Geithner or Secretary Paulson. And I wasn't surprised by that because I think their objective was to find a way to get parties together and to get a deal done.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, because obviously, as I'm sure you know, in Sorkin's book anyway, this is one of perhaps the little levity moments in his book where Fold calls you twice and you say you're not interested, and he calls Geithner and says, what the hell's going on here? You're telling me to call Bob Diamond, and Diamond's telling me he's not interested.
That's the spirit of what I was trying to convey, mm-hmm. Yes. And it was difficult, and I was precise with Dick because I respected the situation he was in, which is that there was no merger. The overlap was too great. The value destruction was too great. And I didn't think it was appropriate for me to say at the time that the only interest Barclays would have would be as if Lehman were in distress and the management team weren't there. That wasn't my position. So it was a difficult position to be in. That was really a position for the Fed and the Treasury. And if Lehman could survive or do a merger, that was great. But what I had said to both the Federal Reserve Bank and the Treasury is, if those ideas are passed, then we would be interested. But only if those ideas were passed. It wasn't that we were expecting that to be the case. It was more if it was the case.
Mm-hmm.
And this was also a time when it was in the news leading up into this week where there were some discussions going on between Lehman management and others. And certainly we hoped that would be a positive outcome.
Mm-hmm. So the calls with President Geithner, Secretary Paulson, and Mr. Fold, are they before or after the Wednesday, September 10th, 7:30 a.m. pre-announcement of third quarter numbers, if you recall?
The discussion of what is our interest in kind of redrawing the situation, given Mr. Steele's no longer being there. And I also had a conversation, I recall. No, I didn't. I think those conversations were very much bringing everyone up to date on what the situation was. It was post the Wednesday earnings call that there was a more serious conversation of should we be a part of looking at it. And I don't recall who initiated that phone call. I don't recall right now whether I was called by President Geithner or Secretary Paulson. I think it was Secretary Paulson or his staff. And what ensued was a call between Secretary Paulson, John Varley, and I, and I think that Wednesday evening, so it would have been Wednesday evening London time, probably midday U.S. time. I think that was the day of the earnings, if I'm not mistaken.
It was.
When the stock pretty much collapsed. And John and I discussed with the Secretary on that call that we did not yet have approval from the board, but we wanted to seek approval from the board for us to start due diligence and start the process of having a distressed bid and a negotiated deal with the Treasury and the Fed. But before we made that proposal to the board, we wanted to make sure that he understood our interest was only at a distress price, both from a value and a management point of view, and two, that we needed his assurance that because we were a UK-based global institution, he would give us every opportunity, if we could get there, to complete a deal and not put the interests of a U.S.-based institution in front of us. And it was important to have that clarity before we could go to the board, or we felt we would just be putting our reputation at risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just continue to walk us through the weekend after the call, after that discussion between Mr. Paulson, yourself, and Mr. Varley, and to the extent you can, also take us through any discussions you're having with folks in the UK government, FSA or otherwise.
In terms of the continue, we decided on Thursday. This call may have been Thursday, not Wednesday.
Okay.
To be honest, really hard to put that week back together. But on Thursday evening, London time, four of us decided to go to the U.S. Rich Ritchie, who is my chief operating officer, myself, and Jared Messier and Tom Kolaris. One of us may have been, Tom might have been in the States, I can't recall. But those were the senior executives from Barclays Capital who I was going to have on the team. With John's approval and the board's approval, we're going to head over. We had asked President Geithner to have a clean room with data for us, but we also made clear that we couldn't begin looking at the data until the next day because we had to have a formal board meeting and approval the next day before we could begin, and that if we didn't get that board approval, we would just stand down. But that was the day of our board call, so we couldn't begin anything until then.
Okay.
But we all arrived in New York. There was no information for us anyway. We had the board approval by the next morning when we were ready to begin work. And frankly, from that point, early Friday through to Sunday around midday, we worked with a small group of outside advisors, both legal firms and advisory firms, on seeing if we could put a bid in or seeing if we could get a deal to acquire Lehman Brothers before Sunday, knowing that the Secretary of the Treasury had told us pretty clearly that he didn't want any government money and he needed a deal before Sunday night.
Okay, so walk us through it.
We had heard that B of A was also looking at it. Part of the reason that we had as frank a conversation with Secretary Geithner as we did. We didn't want to be put at a disadvantage. And our feeling of that, I don't know if we ever knew for sure, Chris, but we had really struggled to get any information or any access to Lehman Management all day Friday, and we're almost ready to walk away. When all of a sudden, by late Friday, I think it was early evening or late evening, all of a sudden we had 100% attention from the regulators, from Lehman Management, and all the data from their law firm. And we have found out subsequently that B of A was there, was in discussions, was dominating the data room and the management, but decided to walk away or just couldn't complete a deal sometime late Friday. And at that time, we now had access. We worked 24/7, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
The data was in pretty good shape because other people had looked at it, so you know we were able to take what we looked at. We had meetings with management. And by management, I had, if I can back up, I had a discussion at noon on Friday with Dick Fole, where I had been clear about if there was any confusion on your earlier calls, I'm here only to do a deal with the Fed and the Treasury if everything else fails. This is a very, very bad situation for you, so I can't engage with you. I need to engage with the regulators. And I have no option to engage you because the regulators are going to work directly with me. We had a very honest, good conversation. It was very hard for him, and he stayed very much in the background to give him credit and allowed me access to the management team and the business. Mark McDade, Jerry Donini, the people that ran the businesses. And frankly, that was a very positive experience because we realized on Friday that the businesses were very strong. The businesses in the U.S. were very strong, utilized very little risk, and that the biggest issues were around the commercial real estate portfolio and the illiquid private equity portfolio. And so on Saturday morning, with the approval of our board, what John and I said to Secretary Paulson and President Geithner was, we were willing to propose a deal to our board into the FSA, circa $3 or $4 a share, so circa $3 billion to $3.5 billion, if we could find a way to ring fence the bad assets, $60 billion in commercial real estate and illiquid private equity, and if the Fed would give us a guarantee for clearing and funding when we open Monday morning. On the first, we just couldn't make the deal work with all the risk and lack of valuation in that part of the portfolio. And on the second, we needed to have a guarantee our clients wouldn't do business Monday morning. Being a UK-listed institution, we're unable to provide that without a shareholder vote, which would take weeks to get in place. But we had also discussed with the FSA that we would not propose a deal to them unless we had funding and clearing comfort from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Any conversations with our regulators at this point, Chris, were being managed by John and Marcus in London, and I was managing the transaction in New York. So I was aware of John's updates to Hector Sants and Hector's response of no disagreement in principle. We will wait to hear what you propose. And we had said, or through John, we had said from the beginning that we would only do a deal that immunized any risk that we didn't feel we could manage. We wouldn't do a deal that hurt our capital ratios. We wouldn't do a deal without a guarantee for funding and clearing. We wouldn't import that problem back to the UK. So there was very good communication between Barclays and the FSA through the process.
So when you have the discussion, or this is actually my question, the discussion with Mr. Paulson and Mr. Geithner that, you know, you can do $3 to $4 a share if you get the $60 billion ring fence and the guarantee for clearing, that was on Saturday at some point, Saturday the 13th at some point?
Yes.
Okay, and I'm going to tax your memory to the extent I can. Do you remember when on Saturday that conversation was?
I think there's a difference of opinion, if I can just say that. My memory is that was Saturday morning, as was John's. I think Secretary Geithner has told me, or it might have been in his book, that he felt he didn't know about the clearing issues and the shareholder vote until later Saturday.
Okay.
But I think we both agree it was Saturday.
And that actually, you anticipate my next question, since this has been a big issue in just about everything, and that is this guarantee issue. Was this the, regardless of whether it was Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon, was this the first time in that you recall the issue being brought up with folks in the U.S. government?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so what's the, when you deliver this message to Mr. Geithner and Mr. Paulson on Saturday morning or afternoon, what's their response?
I'm going, Chris, as you would understand from memory, through a period that was 24/7.
Right.
No sleep, one meeting after another. In terms of the ring fence assets, my memory of the response from Secretary Paulson was twofold. One is, Bob, I said there's no government money. And two, that's your problem, not mine. Get someone to fund it. And my response was, I heard you clear. Absolutely, I heard you clear that there is a commitment that there's going to be no government money. And if it needs government money, that they're going to go into bankruptcy with Lehman Brothers. But I said it's my, I feel it's appropriate for me to offer you the best terms I can do and let you make that decision. I can't make that decision, and you know, it's not in my gift.
Mm-hmm.
But what I can do is I can give you the best terms that Barclays can do, and then you can weigh that against bankruptcy.
Right.
And the best terms we can do are we can't, and I'm not going to go through all the reasons with you, Chris, so I'm happy to another time. The complexities of the commercial real estate, it was too much risk and too poor valuation for us to ever put on our balance sheet. The share price of $3 to $4 a share was assured that we would have positive capital treatment. The illiquid private equity was a capital issue. It wasn't a valuation issue. It may have been valued poorly, but not by a lot. The issue was under Basel III, which we were under in the UK, it would have taken more capital than the entire investment bank.
Hmm.
So through U.S. regulation at the time, they weren't charged any capital for the $10 billion in illiquid private equity. And therefore, it wasn't that they were not valuable. It was that we couldn't, under our capital rules, we couldn't take them on. So this is why it was a difficult call of whether that's government money or not. But what I said to Secretary Paulson is, we would be willing to take part in an industry-wide self-liquidating trust. So our proposed deal, if we could get those agreed, was that we would buy, that Lehman would stay intact. Sorry, intact is the wrong word. Lehman Brothers would stay, and we would offer to buy everything that we wanted. And so Lehman Brothers would be left with the $60 billion in illiquid assets. We'd leave the preferred stock. We'd give our purchase price to there. And at the end of the day, there was a hole of roughly $15 billion in terms of funding. And it, our proposal was that only if Barclays called other firms to help fund that, that wouldn't be appropriate. But if the government called other firms and said, as an alternative to liquidation into bankruptcy, how about this, that would be the way to work it out. And I think my understanding to this day is that Secretary Paulson did a tremendous job in getting people to pay attention and to focus and to look at that, and that there was a very high likelihood that we got through that hurdle,
mm-hmm.
and that we got the funding for that if everything else fell into place. On the guarantee for clearing, our view was that the right person to provide the clearing for funding and clearing for the clients was the Fed, because they controlled the money wire and the security wire. That, of course, there's risk, but it was very, very remote because it was the Fed clearing system. And we could understand that that would have the perception of being federal money, but the truth is, sorry, not the truth, but the reality is we would be able to provide the first loss for a couple of billion, and that it would be, if they analyze liquidation versus that they'd come out on the side if it's better to give the guarantee. They felt that the FSA should give the guarantee, or the FSA should override the shareholder vote. And I know from meetings I've had after the fact with Chancellor Darling, with members of the FSA, that the conversations Saturday and Sunday between U.S. Treasury and Fed and the U.K. Treasury and FSA were around that. And our view from the beginning was that we would not propose a deal to the FSA without the guarantee. We would not ask them for it. It was not within the FSA charter. And we certainly couldn't ask the U.K. Treasury to override a shareholder vote at a time of turmoil in the financial markets.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I understand the other side as well, which is that from the very beginning, Secretary Paulson made it very, very clear that he did not believe it was appropriate to put government money in, and that it was a better alternative to go into liquidation. I'm sorry if that's a bit confusing, but I'm trying to balance both sides of it in conversations over a long 24-hour period.
No, it's not. At least I don't think it's confusing. Maybe I'm just too simple. But let me ask you something, because we have heard from, and I really just want your response on this. You know, several folks we've talked to have said, you know, the fact that Barclays came back on Saturday or whenever it was and said they weren't willing to guarantee, let's just say that several folks have told us from inside the New York Fed and other places that they were less than pleased, and they said, look, everybody knew that that was a requirement of the deal because that is exactly how the J.P. Morgan Bear Stearns deal went down, and for that to come up as a stumbling block was not received happily, shall I say, by several people that we've talked to in the government. I've heard what you've said. How do you respond to that other than by what you've already told me?
I think we came. What did I say to that? I think that's their opinion.
Okay. So, other than you've mentioned the $60 billion of private equity and commercial real estate that Barclays was not interested in acquiring, what other problems is the word I'll use, surprises did you guys find in conducting the due diligence from Friday night through Saturday and Sunday?
I think we're able to manage through it.
No, I get that. I take it that when you made the determination that you weren't willing to buy $60 billion of the private equity and the commercial real estate, you mentioned earlier that there, on the commercial real estate side, there were valuation issues. On the private equity side, it was a Basel III capital issue. Were there any other, surprises in terms of valuations or otherwise that you discovered in doing the due diligence at Lehman other than those two areas?
Given the turmoil in the financial markets, I think other things were, if I could say it broadly, as expected.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But certainly, Chris, to have a $3 to $4 share bid, excluding those assets in an organization that had at one time had a $40 or $50 share price, the turmoil in the financial markets had lowered the asset value significantly, but we're able to work through those and still have a positive share price.
Mm-hmm. Now, I may be getting this wrong.
I don't want to be churlish. There were issues, but we're able to resolve them and value them.
Right. Now, I may be getting this wrong, but I think it was Sorkin's book. I may have seen it somewhere else. But the implication was, at least, that you found out about the deal not going down, and because of the guarantee, whether either the FSA being unwilling to waive the shareholder approval requirement through a phone call with Mr. Paulson, as opposed to finding it out, I guess, internally from the FSA or otherwise. Can you just walk us through how you found out about the deal not working?
I had a call from Bart McDade, who was at the Fed, and had just heard from Secretary Paulson, President Geithner, and Chairman Cox that the deal was off.
And the deal was off because?
That was the phone call I got.
I get that, but where I'm a little unclear is that it, and maybe I just misunderstood you, it sounds like from your description so far that, you know, on the one hand, the entire time Mr. Paulson has said, you know, look, there's no appetite for government assistance, and at the same time, you know, your negotiations with the U.S. government is we need the ring fence deal and we need the guarantee for clearing from the U.S. government. So help me understand how McDade calls you and says the deal's off, when you've been having these conversations all along, understanding that that was a disagreement point throughout the weekend.
I was very surprised to find out. In fact, I had just come off a call with our board, giving him an update that it looked very positive on the illiquid assets, the $60 billion. We got a very positive report that could potentially be resolved, and that one of the things the Fed and the Treasury had done is ask us to see if we could find a third-party guarantee we talked to as many people as we could who could provide that kind of a guarantee. In this market, you know, we felt we're doing our best, but we didn't have high expectations. And I felt that, you know, balancing liquidation versus the Fed providing a guarantee for clearing and funding, I felt that the other hurdle was much bigger, the $60 billion in illiquid assets. So I was feeling pretty good and thought we probably would get a guarantee for clearing and funding. And I was surprised not to have heard from either the Treasury or the Fed, nor had anyone on the Barclays on our board or executive team. So we were surprised. Frankly, when Bart called me, I thought he had bad information.
Really? So did you? Did
he then told me, and I got to know Bart fairly well in a short period of 48 hours.
I'm sure.
But he had said that it was specifically those three gentlemen that had announced it to the group.
Mm-hmm. So did you expect the clearing guarantee to come from some private sector solution or from the government or a mix or what? What was your expectation that made you so surprised by the McDade phone call?
No, my surprise at the McDade phone call was that that any discussions were ended and that their decision was to move to liquidation.
Mm-hmm. So this make sure I'm understanding you correctly. I mean, we heard this, frankly, from other folks, too. Was the belief that, look, the alternative of bankruptcy is a worse alternative than the government providing the clearing guarantee?
Anything I would say is speculation. I can only give you the facts. Listen, I think this is a time of huge turmoil. And I know there was a feeling, my sense from everyone I've talked to is that the U.S. felt that the U.K. should provide the guarantee for clearing. Barclays would not have proposed a deal to our regulator without a guarantee from either the Fed or a third party. We thought, to be honest, the third party was very unlikely. But we had expected from the time we had the discussion on Saturday morning that if we couldn't get a guarantee from the Fed, it was unlikely to have a deal. And I do know only because I've been told this, both by Secretary Paulson, President Geithner, but as well as by Chancellor Darling and others in the FSA, that the U.S. officials were hoping the U.K. officials would either provide the guarantee themselves, which wasn't part of our discussion, or they would override the need for a shareholder vote, which I'm not sure was in their gift, but it certainly wasn't something they would contemplate at this time of financial turmoil.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any? I know earlier you've mentioned that Mr. Varley was the individual talking to folks at the FSA. Were you having any discussions, or do you know if there were discussions with the FSA about either of those two possibilities, them waiving the shareholder vote requirement or providing the guarantee?
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't clear. I know there were many conversations from the time we had this discussion with the Treasury and the Fed Saturday morning. Through Sunday morning, there were many conversations between the Treasury slash Fed and the FSA slash Treasury in the UK, none of which were we privy to,
mm-hmm.
or none of which were we asked about or informed of.
And understanding that, were Barclays representatives, you or Mr. Varley or anyone else, having discussions with the FSA about either waiving the shareholder vote or the FSA, or whatever entity it would be in the UK government, providing the guarantee?
Just the opposite. What we had said to our regulators is we would only propose a deal to them for approval if we had a guarantee for funding and clearing.
Okay.
And we told them we would not expect them to do that, mm-hmm. being a UK regulator, where this is a U.S. issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't aware that anyone had asked them to override the shareholder vote.
Okay. So what
we're totally aware that anyone asked them to provide the guarantee. We were not privy to those conversations.
Okay. So what kind of, I know you guys ended up buying the broker-dealer out of bankruptcy, but before we get to that, what kind of fallout did you guys see, both specific to Barclays and overall, from the Lehman bankruptcy?
You know, I think in some ways, there are many people that can now comment with beauty of perfect hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's in the record of what happened. I don't know if it would be good for me to, if it's helpful for me to comment on that.
Are there any specific unexpected negative impacts on Barclays?
No, I think the issues that we faced were more for the financial markets and the industry, which we all saw.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So why don't you just then, to close it out, walk us through the acquisition of the broker-dealer out of bankruptcy. I've at least seen in the documents and from other interviews believe that Mr. McDade gave you a ring to at least see if you folks were interested, and then that led to it. But if you could walk us through that, that would be helpful.
Yeah, that's right. It was around 6 Sunday evening. We were aware that the deal was off sometime between 10 and noon. I get very confused.
Mm-hmm.
There was then a tremendous amount of work to do in the afternoon for all the firms to prepare themselves for the impending liquidation of Lehman Brothers, particularly around the derivatives. I got a call around 6 when I had gotten back to the hotel. And Bart asked the question, if we file for bankruptcy tonight, would you have an appetite to discuss taking LBI, Lehman Brothers, actually I'm not sure what the Lehman Brothers U.S. broker dealer out of bankruptcy.
Right.
And I had never contemplated that that was a possibility. And what I said is, you know, the board's all in bed. It's late in London now. John Varley will have been in bed. And I can't agree to anything without discussing it with both of them. But in principle, if you did go into bankruptcy tonight, which I don't think you will, I remember saying, I'm sure there's going to be some way to save the situation. But he assured me that was likely going to happen. I said, if that happens, in principle, would we have an interest? Absolutely. I mean, we didn't do all the work because we didn't think there was a value-creating opportunity here and something that would be good for the financial markets and good for the safety and soundness. So, in principle, yes. But what would probably be good is that we get a little bit of sleep. And if you can email me and text me if you do go into bankruptcy, I'll get up. We can all meet again at 4 or 5 in the morning. But by that time, I'll have a time to discuss with John Varley and the board. It was interesting. When I got the email and the text, as I got up pretty early to check on the situation, I both had an email or text, I forget which, from Bart telling me that they had gone into liquidation and they would like to meet. And I had an email from John asking me if I thought we should stay at the table now that they've gone into bankruptcy. So John and I talked about it. We talked to the board. They gave us the okay. We began meeting around 4 or 5 that morning and went right through until Tuesday afternoon when we had a deal agreed pending approval by the bankruptcy judge.
You had mentioned that once the deal fell through, that Barclays had a lot of work to do to prepare for the bankruptcy, and including derivatives. Can you explain what you guys had to do?
I had to get all the teams arranged. I think that was my role.
We've heard about this. You know, derivative counterparty unwinding session Sunday night. Was Barclays part of that?
Yes, but I wasn't personally.
Okay. Understanding you weren't there personally, can you tell us what you do know about how that worked? Others have also explained it to us. We're just asking folks that even have a tangential knowledge about it to explain what was going on.
Well, I think it's interesting, actually. I was managing the org. I was CEO of Barclays Capital, so I was aware that the teams were there. I think what's significant of the effort? I think contrary to public belief before the liquidation and after the liquidation, that the derivatives, while they created pain for people, were collapsed and solved within 24 hours, where everyone knew exactly where they stood. Money changed hands, and while some people lost money, it was clear what they lost, how they lost it, and they could, you know, move on.
Mm-hmm.
The crisis for the financial markets and the crisis for the Lehman bankruptcy was around the vanilla cash securities and the bankruptcy process. And while most people worried about the derivative, it was actually the straightforward lending business that created all the issues for the financial markets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I've seen in some of the documents that the guy that used to be at Citi, I think his name was Michael Klein, or actually I think maybe he still was at Citi at the time, he was an advisor to Barclays. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir.
Okay, can you just describe what, I mean, other than being an advisor, can you just describe what his role was in the transaction or in the almost transaction?
Just that. He was a traditional M&A advisor.
Okay.
But before the Lehman deal, Barclays didn't have its own merger and acquisition department, part of the reason for the acquisition. So we had that. It was important to hire an advisor who had expertise in doing mergers and acquisitions.
Just a couple of other cleanups. I've at least seen in some of the documents that in addition to the $60 billion ring fence and the guarantee, and maybe this is somewhat related to the guarantee, but I don't think so, that Barclays also needed assurances that the PDCF would be available if Barclays took on Lehman and they would have avoided the bankruptcy. Was that part of the necessary terms of the deal, and if so, can you explain that?
No recollection of that, no.
Okay. We know from talking to other folks, this is somewhat tangential, that the Fed actually expanded the types of collateral that were eligible to finance with the PDCF Sunday night. Do you have any knowledge of that, and were you involved in any discussions regarding that?
No.
Okay. Look at my notes. Bear with me for 1 minute. Okay, let me move on to the broader questions on causes of the financial crisis and ask you about that, since you've given me plenty of time on what happened with Lehman. And that is just that broad question. I mean, now that you've had a couple of years to think about it, what do you see as the primary causes of the financial crisis?
Well, with the caveat that this is, perfect hindsight today, looking back.
Sure.
And that there are many, many brilliant people giving their opinions. I think the two dominant underlying causes, and there were many and it was complicated, were monetary policy and public policy. I think monetary policy of exceptionally low interest rates for an extended period of time during relatively strong economies created an environment where there was excess liquidity and very little penalty for poor risk decisions. And I think that showed itself not just in the financial services industry, but in corporations, in governments, in individuals. Secondly, I think the public policy around the mortgage market in the U.S., the feeling of, and again, this was 2020 hindsight, but having money available for mortgages with no money down, with very poor documentation or very little documentation, created an environment with, probably a poor origination of securities or poor origination of mortgages and loans to those two things taken together, I think, were the driving forces.
Okay. Let me follow up on that a little bit. You mentioned, obviously, we've been looking a lot at the growth in non-traditional mortgage loans in the decade of the 2000s. Why do you think that happened?
I'm not knowledgeable in the area.
Okay. Another area that's somewhat related to the first point you made about monetary policy and low interest rates was the flow of foreign capital into the U.S. that was apparently chasing yield and apparently thinking that there is nothing safer than U.S. real estate. And any opinions on that, or is that part of what you meant by monetary policy, also the inflow of foreign capital into the U.S.?
Yeah, I would have thought that was a bit more an issue of monetary policy for the world and not just for the U.S., but driven to some extent by the U.S. Mm-hmm. But I think that demand, it wasn't a flow of capital into the U.S. as much as it was a demand for return in a low interest rate environment.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly we saw institutions make poor risk decisions around additional return because of the very low interest rates. So I think that's kind of the overall rubric of the monetary policy.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing we've looked at over the decade of the 2000s was a couple of related things. One, this whole originate-to-distribute securitization model, and two, the growth in structured finance, you know, going from just those wonderful straight vanilla pass-through mortgage-backed securities to tranched mortgage backs to CDOs to CDO squared, et cetera, and then three, really, reliance on the rating agencies, in particular rating securities AAA. Any opinions on any of those three areas as contributing causes to the financial crisis?
I think you've shifted gears a little bit, Chris, from what are the underlying causes to what are the contributing causes. And I think there's many contributing causes, but the underlying the monetary policy and public policy drove a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
Are there issues that need to be resolved in terms of the model of the rating agency? Sure, I think most people would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Was there too much complexity in some of the highly structured products? Yeah, I think most people would agree with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those were not the causes.
Okay, so let me just to wrap up then. Anything I've asked you everything I wanted to ask you, but in case there's anything you haven't told us in regards to Lehman or in regards to cause of the financial crisis, here's your shot.
No, I thought it was a well structured interview.
Mr. Diamond, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Bye-bye.